Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Attack IQ. Big thanks to them for that. Attack IQ's very own Chris Kennedy will be along in this week's sponsor interview to talk about how at some organizations, threat intelligence has moved from being a nice to have to being central to blue team efforts. As you'll hear, he says MITRE ATT&CK makes threat intel actionable, and some orgs who are playing on hard mode are really kicking some goals that way. That is this week's sponsor interview with thanks to Attack IQ. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, last week we spoke about Google Tag's report about this mysterious Indian hacker for hire company. Reuters and Citizen Lab have now published a whole bunch of additional information on that.
Yeah, the story has certainly been fleshed out a lot since we talked about it last week, because it was a bit, you know, a little bit vague exactly what the story was. But now, yes,
Well, it's funny, like last week we were saying, gee, wonder why this isn't making bigger news. And then like yeah. Now it's just everywhere.
Yeah. The Citizen Lab and I think some researchers from Norton LifeLock, is that what they're called now? They've been tracking this crew, which they've dubbed Dark Basin, which is a private sector hacker for hire crew out of India. The company appears to be called Bellatrox. And yeah, they've been seen carrying out, you know, years worth of, you know, phishing and intrusion into, you know, just, you know, a real grab bag of organizations and individuals and law firms and all sorts. And Citizen Labs done, you know, sort of an interesting set of analysis where they've, you know, they managed to, I think through looking into the URL shortness they were looking, you know, that they were using, figure out a bunch of the targets because email addresses were in the URLs that were being shortened, and then use that to go out and, you know, make contact with a bunch of the organizations that have been targeted and try and do some sort of analysis about what the, you know, relationships between the targets were. And yeah, it does come out as looking like, you know, a mercenary hacker firm breaking into people, you know, in lawsuits and, you know, climate change related activism and all sorts of things, you know, presumably for real money.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's even funnier than them using URL shorteners. I mean, there was a Russian crew, one of the Russian APT crews got, you know, pretty severely embarrassed when they left, like they were using a third-party URL shortener, but they forgot to like tick a box or something, which meant that anyone could come along and see all of their shortened URLs, which gave up all of their targets. But this one, I mean, this is even worse because they actually made their own URL shorteners, but they just did it sequentially. Like each shortened URL was just like increment by one. So that let Citizen Lab completely enumerate like tens of thousands of targets and put this whole thing together. They worked on this thing for like over a year. Yeah, the company's called Bellatrox Infotech Services. And I mean, you've got to expect that there's going to be an extradition request for the guy who runs this company. Apparently DOJ are already investigating some of this. So, I mean, it's a pretty big story.
It is certainly a big story. And the, you know, there's a few aspects to it. Like one is the, you know, the way that it's being, you know, who's paying the bills ultimately, because obviously like this crew has been working on this kind of stuff for something like 7 years, according to the Citizen Labs research. So, you know, that's a lot of time. There's, you know, a number of people that work there. You can see them on LinkedIn getting endorsements, you know, from people for their hacking services, which is pretty wild.
He really knows how to spearfish a Gmail box, you know, yeah, like, plus one endorse for skill, you know, owning activists' Gmails.
But there's also, yeah, like the guy that runs this, Sahil Gupta, apparently has already been indicted by the US for doing kind of hack for hire stuff a few years back, you know, still at large in India. There's no, it's a little bit unclear as to exactly what happened with that particular prosecution. But yeah, like this has obviously gotten kind of too big for it to just be as under the radar as it was. And it just kind of shows, you know, that, you know, obviously there's one firm doing it, there's a whole bunch. And, you know, clearly there is a real market for them. Like I was surprised at the scale of this. I mean, the, you know, the number of customers they must have had to support this work. And, you know, I can't imagine it was cheap.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, all they were doing really was access to mailboxes, and it was mostly phishing, right? Like, so it's not like they were developing like APT grade malware and, you know, that sort of stuff.
Which I guess is actually one of the other points I was going to get to, was that, you know, in the end, this stuff does work, right? It's good enough to get workaday hacking done, and that you don't need, you know, the full suite of, you know, high end capabilities. That this kind of, you know, do some phishing, get in some mailboxes, steal some documents, you know, is kind of enough for, you know, if you're going after, you know, people involved in a lawsuit or people involved in, you know, the, you know, sort of corporate stuff, corporate activism or whatever their targets happen to be, you know, it does get the job done, which is, you know, depressing in its own way.
Yeah, I mean, look, you look at the targeting here and what they were going after. They were going after the private equity firm, KKR. They were going after Muddy Waters, the short-selling firm. They were going after all sorts as well as activists, and it just looks like, yeah, straight-up money behind this. And, you know, as we heard last week, Google Tag's Shane Huntley appeared on Risky Business to say that, you know, he believes that certainly this group, and presumably it is this group he was talking about, the Indian Hacker for Hire firm. I'd be surprised if there was another one that we're talking about in the space of a week. But, yeah, he also pointed out that he suspects that they are also doing some work for governments. So, yeah, great story. There's a couple of great links in this week's show notes, including a link through to the Citizen Lab post about it. Yeah, so check it out. Now, moving on to this is kind of unbelievable, right? And people who follow me on Twitter would have seen me tweeting about this. Forbes has got a headline up which says, you know, huge cyber attacks attempt to silence black rights movement with DDoS attacks. And sure enough, you know, they've got some data here that says, you know, attacks against like black rights movements have increased by a factor of like over 1,000 times, right? And then you see who provided them with that data, and it's Cloudflare. Nazi enablers, Cloudflare. Who are currently hosting a hate site that refers to black people using the N-word and mocks mixed-race ill children. And that site is called Chimp Mania. And they host that site. And now they're doing marketing campaigns about how they're protecting black rights websites. They can eat 1,000 dicks. They can eat 1,000,000 dicks. They can eat all the fucking dicks, as far as I'm concerned.
1,000 times more dicks than last week, yes. Yeah, this is just, it's pretty shameful. I mean, the, you know, leveraging this for marketing spin. And okay, sure, they did soak some DOS up, like, but that's also kind of what they do. And as you say, like, it's hard for them to be able to just come out and say, oh, look at us doing good, when at the same time they're Nazis, right?
I want to see them do a marketing post about how they've protected Nazi websites and that Chimp Mania site. Go on, do that post. Do an honest blog post where you talk to us about the racists that you harbour. You talk to us about the Nazis that you harbour. Eat all the dicks. Eat all of the dicks.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
Don't worry, listeners. We're going to move on into more fun, you know, InfoSec news and stuff. But how do you lack the insight in a situation like this to publish a post like that? You know, how do you not see what dickheads you being? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's an amazing lack of self-awareness. Like, it is incredible. If you think Black Lives Matter, get the Nazis off your platform. Moving on. On to the next item. And this is an interesting one. Comes to us via The Verge. IBM apparently will no longer, quote, offer, develop or research facial recognition technology. And they're saying that, you know, there's too much potential for abuse and, you know, just in light of protests and blah, 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 blah. But one does question, and this is the funny thing is, you know, maybe some of us at Risky Biz HQ are a little bit cynical because our immediate reaction to this was perhaps this is just an excuse for them to exit a market that they weren't really performing in.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, maybe we're a little cynical, but IBM perhaps wasn't super well known for having extremely functional facial recognition tech. And maybe it is an excuse to exit the market. Maybe it's, you know, shameless marketing as well. But either way, I mean, I guess it's good that we see corporate, you know, big corporate names saying something, but, you know, the facial recognition thing is going to need more than just, you know, IBM exiting a market that maybe they weren't doing so well in.
France is launching a bug bounty program into its contact tracing app. And we actually have seen some pretty bad bugs in some apps. We're not talking about so much the so-called Gapple ones, right? But these are roll your own apps from various countries. One of the apps with big problems was from Qatar, and Amnesty International did a big post about that on May 27. Claudio Guarnieri actually reached out to me about that. We didn't cover it at the time, but it looks like the French government wants to find out if they've got similar problems, which is a good thing to do. But look, as Brett Winifred pointed out in this week's newsletter, it looks like contact tracing apps may have flopped a little bit. There was huge uptake in Australia, but we sort of peaked at around 25% of the population. And I don't think anyone else has really done much better.
Yeah, like, I mean, even in Qatar, the example where they had like mandatory use of the applications, right? The question is whether or not this has really been a particularly effective thing. And, you know, it's good that there have been a variety of different approaches. You know, the French one was interesting in that it was built by, you know, kind of a consortium of open source and volunteers and then adopted as opposed to being centrally designed by the government, which is a thing you'd normally expect would result in a mess, the central design by the government angle. I mean, but then supporting that with, you know, bug bounties and things like that is, you know, an approach that may end up giving them something a bit different, at least from the security perspective. But yeah, you're right. The overall kind of utility of technology-assisted contract tracing, you know, through, you know, Bluetooth and peer-to-peer stuff versus just good old-fashioned make a note of where you've been, yeah, maybe it hasn't been as effective as we would have, you know, as we were hopeful of, you know, a month or two ago.
We did actually see a report out of the Victorian Health Service here in Australia that said that they used the technology to identify a close contact that they would have otherwise missed. So I think it is helpful, but certainly not as helpful as we sort of hoped it would be. But it's difficult to measure as well, because you look at a lot of the countries where these apps have rolled out. And as I say, the Australian one at 25% adoption is actually at the more successful end. But we recorded no new cases yesterday. And I believe New Zealand, your country, is now COVID-free, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many other kind of moving parts in the puzzle that it's hard to tell, you know, whether the contract tracing specifically was, you know, super effective or whether it was just kind of one of the many, many things going on as different countries grapple with it.
We got this next story from CyberScoop, written by Sean Lingas, that looks at a bunch of senior executives at a German company that was tasked with procuring personal protective equipment, them being targeted by parties unknown.
Yeah, and very, very rapidly after the German government kind of issued some edicts to, you know, have a number of companies get, you know, sort out manufacturing and distribution of PPE, and then very, very soon after, you know, a bunch of the executives there get targeted. Now, the research from IBM didn't say whether or not they were just targeted, whether or there was subsequent successful intrusions. But yeah, there's not a correlation between very, very rapid moving on targets once the government had done a thing. You know, that's really interesting.
Yeah. Now, look, I want to talk now about a story that ran on risky.biz. This is one that I was really proud to publish on the site. It was written by Brett Winifred, our editor, and it really takes a good look at the global pharmaceutical supply chain. It looks at vaccine research and sort of looks at what various SIGINT agencies are actually looking for when they're going off and owning all these pharmaceutical companies. I actually asked Brett to just give us a bit of info on his report, and here's what he had to say.
So we spoke to executives from pharmaceutical firms. We spoke to CSOs and former CSOs at medical research institutions. Spoke to cyber threat analysts. We spoke to patent lawyers. Anyone that could help us understand what the target was in these attacks. What are these actors going after? The pharmaceutical manufacturing process crosses a lot of borders. It takes a lot of time. It deals with both raw materials and specialist medical equipment that is fairly easy for one state to corner the market on. So in a lot of ways, some of these state-backed actors are probably just doing their homework to make sure that they're not going to get caught by surprise. If a particular vaccine or treatment were to be successful, they'd want to make sure that they have necessary access to the raw materials and the specialist equipment they need to produce or acquire that drug or vaccine. Should there be any geopolitical conflict that prevents them buying it on the open market?
So, yeah, I mean, it's a really fascinating piece. I mean, Brett did all of it. I helped out a tiny bit. There was one moment where I spoke to one of my contacts who has a lot of visibility into, you know, targeting. And I asked, you know, what are they going after? And this guy told me, look, they're pretty much taking anything that isn't nailed down, right? Like, so it's not even clear that they have clear tasking. I know you've read the story, Adam. What did you think of it?
I thought it was a really good kind of summary of how everything fits together. And there's a bunch of moving parts in the story that, you know, I just didn't really understand. Like, I mean, the complexity of modern pharmaceutical supply chains and the extent to which, you know, having a foreknowledge of what drugs may end up working and what the prerequisites might have to be, for example, and being able to hedge those in advance, right, to try and control those in advance, and just all of the kind of global interconnected nature of, you know, drug manufacturing and testing and research and patents, you know, the way they all fit into it. So yeah, there's just a lot of moving parts that I didn't really, you know, that I was vaguely aware of, but didn't understand how everything fits together. And it explains much, you know, why we've seen such a, you know, sort of almost scattergun approach, because we don't necessarily understand all of the parts of that puzzle that, that they're trying to pull together through espionage. And of course, also the, you know, the aspect of where states, you know, believe it's actually in their best interest and within their rights, you know, in, within their sovereign rights to just do that, right? To go and help themselves to, you know, the Chinese, for example, to go and help themselves to, you know, be able to make drugs that are, you know, being developed in the US just in case they end up working. Hey, why not?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Brett worked on this for weeks, right? So we've been talking about it the whole time. There were so many crazy twists and turns through this. He actually managed to get an interview with a C-suite executive at a humongous pharmaceutical company. And, you know, that was a really interesting thing, because you ask someone like that, if you were the health minister of a country that had, you know, and you could ask your intelligence service to go out and get any information, you know, what would you ask them to go and get? And they all loved the exercise. You know what I mean? They loved the thought exercise of, ooh, that's, you know, that's really intriguing. And I think one of the great quotes from that particular person that appears early in the story is when, you know, Brett pointed to these Chinese companies who said, well, look, we're manufacturing these copies of these American drugs and we figured out how to do it from the patent applications. And, you know, this executive just said, that is a complete lie, because we always obfuscate manufacturing methods in our patents, even though we're not supposed to, because so that this doesn't happen. So it just, I mean, it's a really interesting look into a very complicated world. I just love this piece. I love it. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, no, it's really, really solid work. And I think everyone should go and have a read.
Yeah, it's in this week's show notes. It's the one called Why Spies Are Targeting Vaccine Research. And big thanks to the Hewlett Foundation Cyber Initiative, who, you know, pay Brett's wage so that he can go and do stories like that. Moving on. This is another good one. Another one from CyberScoop here. This one by Shannon Vavra. A bipartisan Senate review in the United States has found that the United States has done a pretty poor job of doing essentially security reviews against Chinese telecoms before they connect into US networks. And, you know, this has led them into a position now where they're having to revoke licenses for like China Telecom and stuff. It's a good read.
Yeah, this is interesting because it's kind of been coming to a head recently. We, you know, with the interaction we've seen between the US government and the, you know, the presence of Chinese operators in the US market, that they now go back and look at how it ended up like this, and, you know, the level of oversight that this particular, you know, committee has been doing does seem pretty shonky. I mean, there's cases of Chinese state-linked telcos, you know, they just haven't had any sort of review, like they just never got around to it, you know, despite them being in the country for years. So yeah, it's a pretty kind of damning look at, you know, a fairly rubbish and relaxed set of oversight on Chinese telecoms operating in the US.
Yeah, it was interesting because when you and I first spoke about this whole issue about China Telecom's license, you know, about to get revoked, you know, we said, oh, maybe this is a bit of politics. And then I had a couple of people tap me on the shoulder and say, no, go look at this particular FCC document. And then Brett ripped into it. And yeah, I mean, it turns out that they really are leveraging their connections to US networks to do some pretty bad things. Like they are leveraged by the state. So it is, you know, this isn't politics, this one. It's pretty amazing. And it's amazing how much the US has actually made public on that. Like when you know where to look, you just look at it and go, oh my God, no wonder they're kicking them out. anyway, what have we got next? More problems with a voting app. I mean, let's not dwell on this one, but this one's called Omni Ballot by Democracy Live. And apparently, yeah, it's not really fit for purpose.
Yeah, this is one of the ones where it generates mail-in voting forms, and there's a bunch of dumb kind of mistakes here where even when you're using this application to generate voting, which you then submit via mail, it's still, you know, telemeters back to the operator all of your, you know, kind of information about who you are, so it kind of defeats the secret part of the ballot, and a bunch of other options for kind of ballot stuffing and things that really you don't want. The research has also identified it doesn't look like there's ever been any effective security review, their vulnerable reporting policy is garbage, all the things you'd expect from closed-source voting software. Unfortunately.
Yet another one from CyberScoop, this one by Jeff Stone. Good work over there this week, everyone. And yeah, it looks like Facebook is suing another domain registrar for allowing people to register shonky domains. So this is the second one, isn't it, that we've seen?
Yeah, at least the second, I think, because yeah, they've been going after a number of the kind of domain privacy registrars and things. And, you know, for the amount of money that those registrars make on, you know, obscuring a domain name or, you know, making the Whois records look stupid, you know, they're really not making much money for it. And I can't imagine they have a whole bunch of skin in that particular game. And I suppose Facebook is imagining they're going to roll over pretty quick and, you know, to send a message to all of the other operators that are making, you know, $1 a month or whatever,
yeah,
doing this kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's my feeling as well, which is like some of the other registrars. Word's going to get around, right? Like after the fifth lawsuit or something, you know, you might want to start grepping star Facebook star and see what pops out, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? And some of these domains were like instagramhijack.com.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, it's I know there's no humans involved in the issuing process anymore, but yeah, like, come on, really?
Catalin Kimpanu at ZDNet is reporting on some more Intel CPU flaws.
Yeah, there's been a couple more, you know, kind of microarchitectural side channel attacks. One which is kind of involved in getting secrets out of the Intel secure enclave by kind of shoehorning the data that the enclave is processing out into a bit of cache that they already know how to, you know, do side channel stuff on. The other one involves a new kind of shared buffer, which is used between CPU cores, which you can then cause to kind of propagate out into an area that they already know how to side channel out of. And that one's interesting because the random, like the hardware-assisted random number generator functions use that. And this is one of the first examples of microarchitectural side channel information leakage between CPU cores. Like all the rest of the ones we've seen largely require you to be on the same core, you know, in a different hyperthread, for example. But yeah, this one is interesting because of that. But it's kind of a niche thing because it only involves stuff that is outside of the main cores and traversing across this, you know, kind of special secret buffer that no one knew about. So cloud environments perhaps care about this. It's also, I think, doesn't affect more modern Xeon, like Xeon E5, E7, and later CPUs. So, you know, compared to some of the other side channel stuff that we've seen, you know, I mean, it's certainly really interesting, but I don't know that it's quite as bad as some of the others. But Intel must be just so sick of this stuff by now.
Ars Technica has a write-up on this by Dan Gooden where it sort of says that you can use this to retrieve things like keys out of the SGX enclave. I mean, that is a pretty big deal.
Yeah. So I suppose I was more thinking about the random, like the cross-core stuff. But yeah, the one where you can use that to get key material out of the enclave is certainly interesting because, I mean, the enclave kind of has one job and not letting the key material out. And in some certain circumstances, you know, DRM is one of the common ones, you know, where the enclave's involved in that, where you do have, you know, untrusted users on the hardware from the point of view of the DRM scheme. So yeah, that is actually a thing that perhaps is more generally applicable than the other one.
As if we give a shit about broken DRM in 2020. Oh. Seriously, it's just like...
I mean, I don't, but, you know.
And look, staying with hardware security, apparently DARPA is going to spin up a bug bounty with SYNAC to look into hardware security issues.
Which I think, you know, is a good idea. There's obviously lots of interesting things to be found in hardware. I was a little confused as to exactly what's happening here. I mean, it talks about, you know, encouraging bounties for looking for kind of sophisticated hardware attacks. And then the amounts of money are not very high. And then you don't have access to the actual hardware and you're supposed to do it. And then they start talking about like COVID data and something in the cloud. And I was a little confused about exactly what this is. And, you know, if you're trying to find complicated hardware bugs, I don't know. It seemed a little strange, the write-up to me.
Yeah. And they quote Joe Fitz in this one as saying, you know, basically he says politely.
he was being very polite.
Good luck finding people who are going to be able to go after these sort of bugs when you're offering $25,000 rewards because it's a very niche skill set.
Yeah, exactly. It did seem a little bit perhaps poorly thought out, but hey, maybe they have some specific targets and scenarios that, you know, are going to work with this kind of scheme. But yeah, on the face of it seems a little bit...
Yeah, now look, we've got a bunch of ransomware stories whiz through this week. It sort of felt like for the last couple of weeks the ransomware crews had a break or something, you know? Maybe they were off having a vacation on along the Black Sea coast, you know, having a good time. They are back on deck. A firm called ST Engineering, they got done, and I think they have some defense contracts as well. So that's,
I mean, they're a big aerospace and defense contractor. I think that they're claiming that this was the American subsidiary, but like that's a big organization, and they have contracts. You know, they're based in Singapore, but you know they do military engineering and, you know, Chinese helicopters and stuff like this.
Yeah,
it's a big place.
Yeah, well, and I think there was a contractor that serves NASA as well.
Got breached. What else have we got? Conduent, which is apparently a big IT services company. They reported $4.5 billion in revenue last year, and they're having a bad time with ransomware.
Yeah, they got themselves amazed by the look of it. And, of course, any time an IT service operator like that gets owned, like, you've got to think of downstream into the customers.
As you are at pains to point out, every time it comes up.
Every time, because.
This one's funny, too, because a whole bunch of QNAP NAS devices are getting ransomware. I mean, that's happened before, but I think there was a bug in them that we spoke about like a couple of weeks ago where I'm like, oh, they're probably going to get ransomware. But I cut that. I cut that discussion for space. Sure enough, QNAP NAS is getting ransomware. What else have we got? Krebs has a write-up about how he tried to let the city of Florence in Alabama know that they had someone in their network who was going to ransomware them, and they were like, yep, thanks, we took care of it. Eventually, when he got to the right person, apparently they didn't take care of it because now they're ransomware. What else have we got? Honda in the United States. This is a good one. It's great to see Kevin Collier's byline back. He's at NBC News now. Honda in the United States, their plants are offline because they've been ransomware. In Australia, the drinks giant, they do beer, milk, all sorts of beverages. Lion, they employ 7,000 people across Australia. They have been ransomware. This is affecting production. What else have we got? We've got a South African healthcare provider that operates 49 hospitals. They've been ransomware. I mean, geez.
It's certainly been a busy week on the ransomware front. And nearly all of those are different ransomware crews, right? I mean, some of them is Maze, there's Double Payment, there's the Snake Gang. There's a whole bunch of people doing it. But that's, you know, I mean, that's what, like, of the list of links in the news, probably what, fully a third of them are people getting like ransomware, you know? Yeah. And that's just kind of not tolerable, you know? On the one hand, like, you know, ransomware is at least dragging the kind of baseline up a little bit, I think. You know, people care about security that wouldn't have previously. But it's just a painful process to watch, you know?
We've also got this story from the Netherlands about a company that got ransomware and then went after their MSSP saying, you know, we pay you so that we don't get ransomware, and they actually got some money in the end.
Yeah, I think the judge decided that security was a thing they could reasonably expect, although the judge also did say that the fact that this company had asked for weaker passwords because the ones that the service provider had set were too strong maybe had, you know, caused them to have a little bit of culpability.
Yeah, but they did get some cash in the end, right?
They did get some cash. Not a whole bunch of cash, probably not enough to counter being ransomware, but yeah, certainly worth thinking about. You know, you go after your service provider, why not?
Well, it's a matter of time, right, before there's a big one along those lines. Hey, tell us about this Java ransomware that CyberScoop's reporting on, because I figure this has got to be your jam. This comes from some research out of BlackBerry and KPMG.
Yeah, so the write-up was a little bit confusing, but this ransomware crew appears to, like, ship their ransomware as a modified, like, entire Java runtime. So not only, like, we made fun of the crew last week that had to install the JRE, you know, to be able to operate their ransomware. This particular set of ransomware, like, they package it into the JRE and then use that to, like, it's like a whole
Trojan JRE is their malware. Trojan,
like, and I think this is like an anti, like, AV evasion kind of thing. Like, if you, like, they're burying the bytecode for their Java malware inside the JVM or inside the runtime environment, which, I mean, that sounds like an engineering, you know, fix looking for a problem. But hey, you know, if it gets the job done, which apparently it does, so.
There you go. We got some exploit code. You remember a while back we spoke about this bug affecting SMB on Windows, but it only affected Win 10. And we sort of came to the conclusion that people needn't panic because, first of all, you know, your Win 10 and modern server, they're going to get patched more frequently. And secondly, on Win 10, at least the desktops, you know, it is not, SMB is not reachable by default. Even on server, I don't think it's reachable by default. So it's unlikely to result, you know, in a colossal planet melting worm, but there is now a proof of concept out there, which is a little bit hit and miss, but certainly veering towards being quite effective.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good example of the kind of, you know, exploit, you know, remote exploit golf that everyone loves to see. You know, taking a bug that really does look very difficult to exploit, you know, remotely, and come up with some way to do it, even if it is a little bit shonky. You know, I don't know that we're going to see a worm for all the reasons we talked about previously, right? SMB compression not being a particular thing, and the range of windows involved. But from an exploit, you know, research and dev point of view, yeah, interesting to go look at the proof of concept and see how they've done it.
We got another write-up here. This is another one from Catalan, and it's about a UPnP bug. And what's interesting about this, I mean, first of all, the bug lets you do some cool stuff like amplification for DDoS. It lets you slide through UPnP devices onto the inside of networks. I mean, you know, it's a cool bug. You can do cool stuff with it. The interesting thing about this story, though, is like when you look at the number of UPnP reachable devices on the internet now, it ain't anywhere near where it used to be, right? So it's kind of like a good news story in a way.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like, UPnP is one of those things that really did need to die. And we've seen implementation bugs in it. But this one's interesting because it's kind of a design thing. Yeah. There's a mechanism in UPnP where you can kind of like register callbacks to subscribe to events that happen. And this is basically being used as a mechanism to then make requests outbound from the device under attacker control. And that, you know, use it for denial of service, use it for data exfil, you know, use it for other, you know, kind of server side request forgery style sorts of attacks. So yeah, it's an interesting bug class, but yeah, thankfully UPnP is just, you know, a shadow of its former self, which, you know, is good given this is a pretty dumb bug.
Yes, thank God. This next story is, I just thought it was really, really interesting when we look at, you know, how technology can be abused. The Commonwealth Bank here in Australia received a complaint from one of its customers that it was receiving abusive messages in the transaction IDs, right? So when you transfer money to someone online, you enter the amount, you enter the account number, and then you enter, you know, invoice number 12345 or, you know, whatever. This customer complained that they were receiving abusive messages from their violent ex-partner. So the bank, you know, did something about that. I don't know exactly what they did about that. But then they actually grepped through other transactions just to see how much of a problem this was. And oh my God, it turns out that this sort of abusive messaging via transaction notes was just endemic.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing we've, you know, certainly heard, I've heard plenty of people doing, not necessarily for abusive purposes, but, you know, for comedy, transferring a buck back and forward between each other's bank accounts and sending messages, you know, when the transactions are essentially, you know, instant and free. But yeah, it's a good example of what happens when you have, you know, any messaging mechanism, you know, whatever it is going to end up being abused by jerks. And I think the, you know, one of the outcomes that's positive from here is them adjusting their terms and conditions to say, hey, you can't do that. And if you do, then we may boot you off the banking platform, which I think is a, you know, a really positive step. And, you know, if they manage to make one less person get abused through that process, then, you know, that's a good outcome.
Brett gave it the best headline in this week's newsletter, which was $1 dirtbags. And I just thought that was fantastic. By the way, if you haven't subscribed, go subscribe to the newsletter. You can just hit risky.biz and there is a subscribe button on the left-hand side and that'll take you through to our subscribe page, which has all of our information on it. Do go and check it out. It's like, you know, usually about 1,600 to 2,000 words of security news every week. Brett works really hard on it. It's great stuff. Anyway, we've got a really good write-up here from Dan Gooden over at Ars Technica. Just still people are giving shit to Zoom over them saying that they're not going to give end users E2E accounts, you know, for free accounts, which, I mean, I don't get the vitriol given that they're not a consumer technology organization. Free accounts are their sales funnel, right? They don't want free accounts. They want paid accounts, and the free accounts lead to paid accounts. That's their model, right? So why are you going to give free accounts a feature that's going to be an abuse magnet? I don't get it. Go yell at Google, right? Go yell at Google for not making Hangouts and Meet end-to-end, right? That makes more sense to me. What I did find interesting about this story, I think it's a really balanced write-up, which talks about how most people don't realize just how much of a problem live child abuse video streaming is. I mean, it's a huge problem, and anyone who's had to deal with this sort of stuff in their job, I mean, they will tell you about it and it will really change your opinion on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Like, this story pulls together a bunch of you know, the nuances of this kind of comms tech that, you know, the trad cyberpunk, you know, let's just crypt everything and, you know, it'll all be wonderful, really just doesn't take into account. Child abuse is one very good example. Also, the interesting aspect of, you know, being able to tie individual users down to some real world
to identity. To a credit card number. I mean, how have people
to billing, to phone numbers.
Not put that together? And Signal as well ties people to phone numbers. WhatsApp ties people to phone numbers. Facebook ties you to an account, right? Like, and unless you've got a giant counter abuse team, you know, just doing this would be insane. And sure, if you want to become a consumer play, maybe you're going to do that, but they don't want to be a consumer play. They want to sell video conferencing services to business people.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree exactly. It makes sense, you know, what they're trying to do. And I do think people are, you know, not really thinking big picture enough, those who are kind of critical of the approach that they've taken.
Yeah, I just think it's nuts. But staying with Zoom, Cisco Talos released details on a couple of bugs.
Yeah, there's a bug here. One of them was pretty dumb client-side bug, you know, where you could send a zip file and would unpack it without checking the paths whilst it was trying to render it. Which,
oh, that's nice old school one. So what, you could just you could just write to arbitrary paths?
Yeah, you could just kind of path traverse up and out and write files out of the file system and use that to compromise people. So that's, you know, that's obviously not the sort of thing you want in any thick client application that has multi-users in it. But yeah, real classic one. I think they had one other bug, which was another client-side one. So, you know, good that they're getting them found and fixed. You know, obviously the other chat clients and messaging systems have had similar sorts of things over the years, but this is the peril of thick client software and why everything's better in a browser.
Indeed. Google has updated its iOS apps so that you can now use things like YubiKeys, which is great because I did actually try to enroll my little Lightning YubiKey on my iPhone recently, and it was didn't support it, and I was very sad. So I'm going to have to do that again, probably later today.
Yeah, no, it's good news. Google's been working on this for a while, and it's just been so clunky using hardware tokens with Google services on iOS up until now. So good they finally sorted this one out.
Yeah, indeed. What else have we got here? We've got a new tool release from Bishop Fox.
Yeah, this is a tool called RMI Scout. It's useful for enumerating things that are available via the Java RMI interface. If you've ever kind of tried to figure out how to attack Java applications that use RMI, which, you know, generally, hopefully nothing should anymore. Loads of things do, unfortunately. If you're ever attacking one of those things, this tool has kind of like a dictionary of the hashes that RMI services are identified by that you can use to scan to figure out what's available if you don't have the source of the service to go and reverse engineer.
They've released similar tools in the past for deserialization stuff, haven't they?
Yeah, well, this is, you need a whole bunch of tooling to try and discover the endpoints that you can talk to and then attack them in ways that work in the particular JRE with the available library. So, yeah, there's a whole kind of set of tools. A lot of Java work, obviously. My sympathies to you for having to
I'm impressed
hack many Java things.
I'm impressed that they released this stuff, I got to be honest.
Yeah, no, they have. Bishop Box have had a pretty good, they've been pretty good at releasing tools and information. And, their style guide, for example, is also really good for pen test reporting. So, yeah, lots of good work comes out of there.
We got a great story from New Zealand here about a stolen key.
Yes, there's a podcast series coming out of Radio New Zealand, our state broadcaster here, that has been looking into a case in the 80s where the New Zealand Security Intelligence Service, like our kind of domestic counter-intel agency, broke into the Czechoslovakian embassy to go and steal the Warsaw Pact cipher codes. The story is kind of being revealed by, the son of one of the people that actually went and did the operation, many, many years after the fact. Now, our SIS is playing kind of coy and saying they can't confirm whether or not they did actually get the Czechoslovakian key material or not. But anyway, just some good Cold War espionage stories, from the town that I live in. So that's been a fun listen.
Have you listened to the podcast yet?
So I'm halfway through the first episode. They only dropped the first one this week. So, and it's really well put together. They've done a lot of work to try and, get all the good people, all the people that are involved to talk about things despite, how far back it is and still how secret it all is. So it's really, really good listen. Well worth it so far.
Well, you can check that out in this week's show notes. That podcast is called The Service. What else have we got here? Ah, GNU TLS, you had one job.
Yes, the little TLS library that could, not, I suppose, had a bug where if you were in the middle of a network connection, you could bypass cert checking through TLS session resumption. This is obviously a pretty bad bug. Fortunately, GNU TLS is largely out of fashion these days. There's not that many things that use it. I still think maybe LDAP on Linux probably still uses it, and that would be
really
bad.
You don't need encryption on that.
I mean, why have, integrity and crypto on your authentication? Who would need that? It's an interesting bug in the TLS 1.2, 1.3 session resumption where you let the client connect to the real server, drop it, and then when it reconnects and uses the resume feature, you can then use the resume without ever having the fake server can do the resume without ever having had the key material. So it's a really interesting, kind of technical bug. I don't know how much... how many GNU TLS systems use TLS 1.2, 1.3? They're probably still SSLv3. But yeah, definitely, crypto bug, comedy bug of the week.
Well, mate, that's actually it for the week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us. And yeah, I'll look forward to doing it all again next week.
Yeah, thanks so much. I'll talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news headlines. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now, and this week's show is brought to you by Attack IQ. They make a breach and attack simulation platform that you can use to test your security controls. So the whole thing is very, very much aligned with MITRE ATT&CK. And as you're about to hear, this week's sponsor guest, Chris Kennedy, says some organizations are actually making much better use of their threat intel these days because they can actually take that threat intel, map the attacker behavior to MITRE ATT&CK, and then test their controls against those specific techniques and wind up with really effective and responsive coverage. Here's Chris Kennedy.
It's very interesting. I've got a very, very big and sophisticated customer, defense industrial, Fortune 5 company. And the person that I work with there is the director of threat intelligence. And I see this person working directly with the CISO on strategic initiatives, with the SOC on modeling and detection engineering efforts, with the vulnerability management team and the connection of threats to vulnerabilities. And I'm like, why is threat intel so important now? And it's because this kind of modeling capability influences everything about what they're doing and why. And so now threat intel is like the most important part of the organization, where it used to be a luxury to the most sophisticated organization.
So walk me through how MITRE ATT&CK and the communication of this type of, you know, threat information, walk me through how that makes threat intelligence more valuable. If you're talking about threat intelligence in its sort of traditional form of like file hashes and IP addresses and domains and things like that, IOCs.
Yeah. So, first and foremost, like that kind of threat intelligence is largely very temporal, and so it's only useful for a small period of time. What's more important is the understanding of the technique and the associated actor with it. And if you understand what those techniques are, then you can then begin to benchmark and measure what are the specific capabilities or controls you put in place to defend against those techniques.
So you might get a bit of threat intel that says this particular group is coming after you, and then all of a sudden you've got an idea of their TTPs more broadly than just the particular bit of malware that came at you or whatever.
Right. Well, yeah, it's important that you come up a level beyond those particulars and you start managing your controls at the technique or the actual procedure level, so you understand how those things work. And when you do so, that's a better way. Of course, there's going to be new threat intelligence. You want to tie these things together, but managing the threat information that's associated and being able to contribute that to your risk program, so you understand what controls are most important, that helps you prioritize strategically to your SOC operations, so you can assure your detection engineering functionalities would actually see that if that's a core control. And that's different than IOCs. This level of information, this level of framework, like in MITRE ATT&CK or the TTPs that are associated, are able to influence and shape all of the core structural components of the security program, where IOCs, are, because of the temporal nature, are basically something that gets fed to the SOC and says, look for this time.
So maybe one of the reasons why I'm a little bit behind you on this is, are you saying that threat intelligence companies are now actually shipping off MITRE mapped techniques with their intelligence?
Well, I can tell you threat intelligence companies are certainly interested in trying to figure out how to do that.
Yeah, okay.
Because a technique may implicate an IOC. Like for example, an attacker will execute command and control through the connection to a known C2 channel and send some form of data out or download a file as a way to receive commands. That's the technique. The IOC is, you will connect to this domain and receive this kind of file or this kind of hash. So the ability to have a control that can detect for those things and monitor for those kinds of things broadly is the important piece. The IOC is the temporal piece. If you don't have ability to interrogate downloaded files, then you have a missing control in the entire stack. And that's a strategic piece of the information there, is that you haven't mapped the specific of the control to the technique that you need.
So one of the things that I've brought up with you a couple of times, right, is that you were all in on MITRE ATT&CK pretty early on, and it was a gamble, right? You made a bet on MITRE ATT&CK, and it just seems to, I mean, if I'm you, I'm thinking that it's even exceeded my expectations in terms of how prevalent it's become. it just feels like every month it's becoming a bigger and bigger deal and just more a part of the landscape, more a part of the scenery. You know, I mean, is that the sense you get as well?
Oh, absolutely. Like we, you know, not so much so that, you know, our company's a founding member of the Center for Threat Informed Defense with MITRE Ingenuity. So we think that's really important, but so much so the industry speaks to itself. Like every company that's out there today is working to align what they do with MITRE ATT&CK. But I mean, the power behind it lies into, on a talk last week with someone else and CISO at a big technology organization. He's like, you know, so many of us don't even know why we bought what we bought. Like, what are the functional requirements definitions for the controls you buy? Most of them are stops malware or, you know,
stops cyber attacks. Thank you very much, Chris.
Stops cyber attacks dead in their tracks.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah.
And now there's a real referential architecture to link to say this is a way to orchestrate your organization by knowledge of these are the techniques I want to actually stop. Real functional requirements. And that's the very powerful piece that I think that organizations that are embracing it see, and that the technology vendors are now saying, well, crap, I need to make sure that I can align with that so I can speak the same language, commonality of lexicon.
Well, I feel like it does put pressure on them, right? Because now there's actually a criteria that can be used to like validate their claims, whereas before there wasn't. Because whether or not you make the claim that your control is, you know, granularly, you know, takes care of this MITRE technique, people are going to categorize it for you and then give you a pass or fail, right? So that's, I think it's probably going to clean up a few dodgy vendors. I just have that feeling. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I absolutely true, and it's already happening. Like first, you got MITRE evaluations that are underway, and they're taking threat actor behavior by threat actor by threat actor, and they're inviting industry to come and contribute their product and pay, and then they will be a third party to provide data about how their product. They don't grade them; they just give you data.
Yeah, about which it's pass or fail per technique, right? Like that gets tricky, though, man. Like even though I'm a big fan of MITRE ATT&CK. That gets tricky because there's for each technique, there's sub techniques and there's different ways and there's stuff that's not in the matrix yet. And I do get a bit concerned that when you give, you know, a vendor a pass on a certain technique, that really it's pretty trivial for an attacker to achieve the same objective just in a slightly different way. Yeah, do you know what I mean? And they're going to slide right by that product, but according to MITRE's testing, it shouldn't be possible. I don't know. That makes me nervous. Well,
yeah, I mean, I guess first and foremost, MITRE just provides data. They're not giving you a pass fail. Here's how we interrogated. Here's how we emulated the behavior. Here's how the product responded. Does that make sense or not? Let industry consume that. So that's great, actually.
I understand that they're not giving you a pass or a fail. They're just giving you, you know, here's what we did to it and here's what happened. I understand that, but that will be interpreted as a pass or a fail. You know, certainly by the vendors, if they can make it look good, you know.
But seeing how the vendor responds to that will actually be very telling, and that's going to be a key part. I think what drives increased quality. The second part to your point is that you know people are going to make decisions based off that, and there needs to be a continuous process. And that's where I think like this is where the breach and attack simulation industry is going to get legs. Is that now that we're going to have more transparent ways to evaluate if these product work. Using real known techniques, then you got to do that when it gets into your environment too, or you detune these kinds of things, or you turn off the key features because they break your applications, that you buy a thing that says yes, and then it says no when you get it deployed. And so you're going to have to have a level of continuous capability to keep that moving. And I think we're best positioned to do that because we're so deeply anchored into how MITRE ATT&CK works. We offer a very transparent attack simulation capability. And we're seeing in the rise of the threat-informed organization that, you know, this concept of continuous automated validation is an integral part of that. Consume MITRE ATT&CK TTPs, align them to the key risks in the organization, and exercise them. Let's see if we're actually defended or not. That's what the new security organization looks like. I'll give you another use case within another customer. This customer had gotten hit with a specific threat actor. I believe it was Fin7 at the time.
Ouch.
And through that analysis, they found that it wasn't in lock stock and barrel aligned with what MITRE said Fin7 was. It had already evolved in some way. There was a couple of techniques that were new and unique. But
like,
and that was
like
fine.
The river flowing around the rock, basically.
Precisely. The continuum has to be faster and shorter is what a good security program looks like. So what they did is they just took what they learned. They used our platforms open so you can actually build those kinds of techniques back in our platform. And then they went and exercised the rest of the environment to validate the new version they saw would actually be adequately defended. They'd actually get detections if that happened again. And it was part of their remediation exercise. You have to be ready for that. We also have a content delivery team within our organization that focuses on understanding what these attackers are doing in terms of how they're shifting and connected to the other components of threat intelligence that are out there studying the attacker behaviors. And we're building that content back into the product continuously.
Chris Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us on the program. It's always great to talk MITRE ATT&CK with you. That seems to be what we talk about all the time, but it's really great to be chatting to someone who spends so much time with it and can really help inform our understanding of it. A great pleasure, my friend, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Great to see you, Patrick. Thanks for the time.
That was Chris Kennedy there from Attack IQ. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to Attack IQ for being a Risky Business sponsor. You can check them out at attackiq.com. And you know what? In terms of tooling that can actually test your existing controls, Breach and Attack Sim, you know, it actually makes a lot of sense. So go check them out, see if you might want to trial this stuff, attackiq.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more Risky Biz. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.